Drew?
Yeah.
You come at the king, you best not miss.
You feel me?
I feel you.
No, don't.
Oh, indeed. I'm John.
And I'm Drew.
And you're listening to The Hourchive,
our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time. We're talking about The Wire.
The Wire.
And it's 2012, and The Wire started in...
2001?
That early?
Look it Premiered up. On June 2nd, 2002, ended on March 9th, 2008, comprising 60 episodes over 5 seasons.
Why are we talking about it? It's been over for 4 years.
Because all the pieces matter. That's why.
I didn't start watching it until after everything had aired.
Yes.
I think it was like 2009 maybe, or 2010 when I found it.
Fresh off the conclusion.
A couple of people told me that it was worth watching.
Mm-hmm. My friend, what did they say? What did they tell you specifically?
I can't remember.
It's the best show, man.
They did.
You gotta watch The Wire. It is so good.
They were actually very, I think, smart about it. So I heard it from two people.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends, whose name is Ted,
mm-hmm.
and another friend, whose name is Diana,
mm-hmm.
and who both of whom I work with or worked with.
Okay.
And I think it was a conversation over coffee or something where... Mm-hmm. One of them brought up The Wire, and the other was like, oh,
that's the best show, man.
Yeah. And I was like, what's The Wire? But they were, you know what? I don't think they were like, oh, it's the best thing ever. I think they were just like, it's a really good show.
They were
you
like,
should check it out.
Oh, my God, don't eat that bagel. Go watch The Wire right now.
Put your coffee down. Go home. Buy the DVDs. This is what Diana sounds like. Buy all the DVDs.
Board up your doors and windows.
Don't do anything until you've watched the whole thing. And get back to me.
Pull out all the food in your refrigerator. Let it spoil.
Don't eat any of it. Just pull it out because you want your room to mirror the corruption and the desolation of the modern day metropolitan city. And that's what it is.
They really made a case for
it. They did.
It.
And so I rented it from Netflix.
Oh. One disc at a time.
It is a hard way. Because you get, rough. Well, if you're like many people who watch this show, you get really into it.
Mm.
You don't get many episodes on a disc.
Right.
And it is tough waiting for the next disc. But anyway, I think they underplayed it to some degree. You know, they're just like, oh, it's a really good show.
Mm-hmm.
You should check it out. So I did, and I was like, oh, my God.
When did you have that oh, my God moment?
First scene.
Really?
Scene one.
Scene one?
I was struck
by... With Snot Boogie?
With Snot Boogie.
Wow.
I was struck. This is how I remember describing it to others. And I never felt like it really truly encapsulated how I felt. But it was such a quiet scene. Like... Mm-hmm. There was no score. It wasn't noisy. There wasn't a lot of like sound. It was just the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a seemingly innocuous conversation mm-hmm. between McNulty, mm-hmm. who you would learn later is like kind of the primary character in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a street kid. And it was just like, I'd never seen dialogue like that, heard dialogue like that in a television show.
Uh-huh.
It seemed very authentic.
Uh-huh.
And I was just struck by how it relied so much on just that conversation. Like, mm-hmm. it didn't try to jazz it up. It didn't, you know, do anything to, like, pull you in with a lot of frenetic action. It was just like, here's a situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and from that moment, I was like, this is amazing.
Mm. I took a little bit longer to come around to it. I didn't dislike it. I didn't. I did not come into it and be like, "Well, this is okay."
When did you think this is an amazing show?
Oh boy, I don't remember exactly. I don't know where I was completely hooked, but it was somewhere between. I'll give you two points here. It happened somewhere in between these. The first point is toward the end of the first season. And I'm not going to say what these names are because I don't think we want to necessarily get into too much detail right here.
Yeah.
But one character on the side of the law says to another character who is not on the side of the law, per se, he says, "Catch you later." And it was at that moment.
You wagged your finger a bit.
I wagged my finger and I said, "This show is gonna be something good." No, that moment was cool because it was at that point that it said, "Okay, this is a show that's not going to give me everything right away." Yeah. You know that this definitely has something more going on.
Yes,
and which is I felt more realistic. If that moment had been portrayed in a regular police procedural show. One, that would have been the end of it. It would have ended right there. Case closed, you know, that's it. They would have gotten everybody. It would have been sealed up really neatly.
Yeah.
And this, in this case, not everything was sealed up neatly.
Yeah.
And I liked that. The second point, this may have been what finally, like, crystallized it.
Yep, okay, I'm in.
Was in the second season when another character, again, I won't go into too much detail, is lamenting there's a sense of loss. there's a point at which this character recognizes that things have progressed from one place to another and there's no going back.
Yeah.
And it was poetic without drawing attention to itself. It was, you know, and that's where the show really became like, it was clear that it was, not only was it not going to tie everything up neatly the way that it was done on other shows, but that's where it sort of said to me, this is more than about these characters. Like, this show is about something more than just these characters. So somewhere in between there.
those two moments.
Yeah. Those are like the two ends of the tuning fork for me. That is The Wire.
Before we continue.
Yeah.
I think we should maybe take a step back and talk about just what The Wire is. So, on its surface...
What is The Wire?
It's a television show.
It's an HBO television
show. On HBO. It aired on HBO.
It's not TV. It's HBO. Isn't that what they're saying?
That was their saying.
Yeah.
On its surface, it's a procedural cop show.
Yeah.
However, it is so much more than that. And as
you go a little deeper...
as the story progresses throughout the seasons, and I think David Simon, who is the creator of The Wire, has stated this, it's more a show about the American city,
mm-hmm.
the modern American city, what it does to the people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so each season focuses on kind of a different part of a functioning city.
Another layer,
yep.
if you will.
Yeah. And it never totally leaves the previous layers,
right?
With a few exceptions, everything just keeps going forward, mm-hmm. which is really impressive, because every season adds new characters and like it starts with so many characters
mm-hmm.
that it blows you away that they continue the stories effectively,
just adding more and more people and pockets of this city.
Yes.
Onto it, yeah.
The creator, David Simon, worked for the Baltimore Sun.
Yeah.
He's a journalist.
He was a police writer. He was on a police beat, like a homicide beat.
And the other sort of co-creator, co-writer, co-advisor was a former Baltimore police officer.
Yes, who worked with Simon.
Like 20 years.
Something like that. Yeah.
Something, and he was homicide.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of the inspiration for the show comes from his experiences,
mm-hmm.
as I understand it. We're going to talk very generally, in very general terms, about the show for about the first half
right.
of our show. And then we're going to get into details. So if you've seen The Wire and you're kind of tired of us being really cagey, we will get there. We're going to talk details, but we wanted this to be somewhat interesting for those who haven't seen The Wire and maybe right. give them a reason to go see it.
Not just give them a reason, force them to.
Yeah, go see it. Them. Go home, get the DVDs, pull
Take your food, out, of the fridge.
remove all the food. I want you said something that made something pop into my head. What is different about The Wire as a TV show? Like, why does it feel so different from every other show?
I think there are about 72 reasons why.
Yeah, I agree.
So number one.
It number is a one. Show.
One.
That was good.
It is, well, like you said, it has a multitude of characters.
And a staggering amount.
Yeah.
Especially by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you start off with a cast that is maybe, I would say, maybe a dozen recurring, like regular maybe cast
more,
members.
Maybe more.
But I think by the end, you probably have close to like 30 or 40 yeah. like regular faces that you may not see every episode, but likely you see them.
You get them. You'll get like a moment. You almost always get a moment with each character.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, seconds long.
Yeah.
You usually get some kind of indication as to what they're up to mm-hmm. at that point in the story.
Yeah.
And whether or not it goes into, you know, a lot of detail depends.
Yeah.
On you know, how important they are to the story at that point.
But the thing that I think really, really separates it is that there's no definite good guy or bad guy.
Yeah. Which is a kind of cliche
right.
a lot of times. You hear that a lot about shows.
Right.
But I've never seen it more... I've never seen it exemplified to such a great degree as I have in The Wire.
Right. And I feel like there's no judgment placed on them
yeah.
by the show itself. I feel like it's not... Like, in most cases... In most shows, there's definitely a way that everything is supposed to play.
Yeah,
on you. You know, you're supposed to either laugh at something yeah. or you think it's, you know, bad, or you think what a character's doing is...
You're supposed to like this person, you're supposed to not like them.
Right. Or like what they've done.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you're supposed to... There's a very direct response that I think most shows try to elicit from you.
In a way, it's very journalistic in the true sense of journalism, reportive journalism
mm-hmm.
in that it simply presents the story.
Yeah.
It doesn't ask you to feel one way or another about it.
Right.
It's just like, here is the story. You do with it what you will.
Yes.
You know, you make your own decisions about like how this affects you, who you think is good or bad or
why.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's actually kind of unsettling because you find yourself rooting for characters that are, you know, in reality, horrible people
mm-hmm.
Who do horrible things.
Yeah. Not necessarily horrible people, but,
I think what is troubling is that you can a lot of times see the rationale behind their actions.
Yeah.
You know, it gives you such a full picture of this character that, you know, you're like, I get why they're doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I understand this. And it's, you know, I think just understanding it makes you feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's sort of coinciding with that is the fact that it does the concept, the conceit of The Wire, the quote unquote wire itself.
Yeah.
The notion that you are sort of eavesdropping on circumstances that you ordinarily would not be privy
yeah.
to, is sort of that you sort of remove yourself from the sort of surface element of many of these scenarios,
mm-hmm.
like a drug deal or mm-hmm. you know, a police bust or something like that. It's not, you're sort of taken away from like just the face value of it. And instead what you're given is a series of interwoven circumstances. You know, it's sort of, everything is sort of interlinked. So it's not just, okay, this is somebody killing somebody.
Yeah.
It's more like this is somebody killing somebody because something else happened. And before that, something else happened. And before that, something else happened.
All the pieces matter. That's another thing that's very different, I think, as far as the show, is how complex and how purposeful the plot is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how they're laying foundation in season one for things that are going to happen in every season following.
Right.
That it's that they're like educating you on the street. Like, here's how the street works.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how the police department works. Okay, you get that. Now we're going to go to the docks. Here's how the docks work. Now here's how the government works. Here's how schools work. Mm-hmm. Like, you get all of these pieces, and they sort of give them to you slowly. It's a slow burn over the five seasons, until by the end of it, you're like, you understand how a city works.
Right.
You see how all the different pieces affect one another. You know that everyone's hands are tied.
Yeah.
No one seems like free to make their own decisions.
Yeah. Because everything that they do is going to impact everything else.
And everything else impacts what they do.
Right.
And it's just staggering and somewhat depressing.
Yeah.
Because you're like, this must be every city. This must be every, you know, major metropolitan city in the United States.
It forces you to see scenarios from multiple views, which I think is not one, I don't think it's our natural inclination to look at that. You know, we sort of want to have a myopic viewpoint of everything, and whether we're conscious of that or not, but it's also not like what our entertainment necessarily caters to.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's so much easier to get a laugh if you have one perspective on something, you know, and it's so much easier to for something to be dramatic if it's, you know, pointedly affecting, you know, a one person's point of view or one perspective.
Yeah.
But it's much harder to make that work, and which is why I think the Wire deserves so much credit, because it does work in affecting you as a viewer, even though you are, you know, you can see something that is tragic, and you have a completely a multifaceted appreciation of why it's tragic.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and what is, I think, layered on top of that, that makes it impressive that you understand the tragedy, is that none of the characters acknowledge these things as tragic.
Right.
Like, for them,
they're just sort of rudimentary, like, daily occurrences.
It's incredible. Yeah. Like, the things that happen in the show that you're, like, expecting a lot of emotional reaction from the characters, sometimes there's none.
Right.
Hey, yo, Kanan. Why you lie to me?
What you talking about?
You said the police kicked your door in. I seen the door. They ain't kicked shit in. How you gonna lie?
Go on, man.
Well, where the package at, man?
Package up my ass, Gump.
Y'all about to.
You're about to. Go on, walk. Gump ass motherfucker.
Y'all was talking too goddamn much. Go ahead, Nay. Get your pack off this bitch so we could go. I ain't want it.
The other thing I think that's very different is the structure of each episode, like the structure of individual episodes. As far as a television show, you kind of touched on it. I don't know if this is really what you meant, but it made me think of, the show doesn't end where you expect it to end. Like, the episodes don't end.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of times you'll feel like you've hit what is the, you know, climax of the episode, and it keeps going.
Yeah.
And yeah. You're like, okay, we're not done. And it doesn't feel like, I never felt that it's dragging on, but it's just like, oh, there's more story to this, you know?
Right.
It doesn't adhere to like what feels like a natural kind of flow.
What we've come to expect from an episode.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There seems to be like this weird, I don't know, rise and fall of, you know, intensity and sort of emotion. And by the end of, when it does end, you're like, oh, okay, or this episode's over. And it sometimes ends, you know, in a way that you, not that you expect it to end, but where you expect it to end.
Uh-huh. Other or times, what seems like a fitting stopping point or a pause, yeah.
But other times it ends on a note of just like, why did they end it there? Like, mm-hmm. what's, in, is there meaning to this? And I think part of it is, you know, to make it feel more realistic, like stories end in weird places. Like in real life, things end, right. You know,
people either, come in and out of your lives yeah. when it's not necessarily convenient exactly. for you, but it's just when it happens. Yeah. yeah.
And it's kind of like poetry in that way where, you know, poetry can have a really strange cadence or mm-hmm. can have a strange rhythm to it. It has odd pauses or, you know, different thoughts are broken into pieces that don't really make sense mm-hmm. on the first read through, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the episodes work a lot like that to yeah. where, you know, there are strange moments of quiet and it just sort of like has this unevenness to it.
Yeah.
That feels strange, but also sort of correct for yeah. what it is.
It feels believable.
Yeah.
Palpably believable.
Yeah.
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 I think it's interesting. There's a whole background. I guess what I'm saying is it's a Baltimore set story. The show is set in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
It's also filmed in Baltimore.
Yes.
It is filmed with people
who live there,
live in Baltimore,
who are not actors,
right? They're just Baltimoreans, and some of those Baltimoreans had a history that actually kind of shaped some of the characters and yes. some of the circumstances that are portrayed in yes. the show a little bit.
Yes,
and I think probably the two most interesting ones.
All right,
Avon Barksdale.
Okay.
And you'll meet him early in the series.
Oh, yeah.
First early episode.
Episode I think. One or two.
Yeah. He's sort of based on an actual dude. An actual guy, yeah, that Ed Burns.
Didn't they, like, take... But the name is, like, two other people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, his name is not reflective of the actual person.
I think there was a Barksdale that they knew and an Avon that they knew, and they kind of mashed those names together. And then put that name on this other person.
Right. Who's Avon, influenced yes. by, yeah, a sort of criminal drug lord that right. Ed Burns busted and David Simon reported on the investigation right. for. And I think it was done with a wiretap is sort of how they broke the
yeah.
case.
Yeah. I think the first season is influenced greatly by an actual... Like the way that the wiretap played out,
mm-hmm.
like how the codes they figured out and the way that the just sort of the overall kind of progression of that case, from what I understand, followed the actual case.
Yes,
in a very close way.
Yes, and what's interesting about that too is that one of the figure of that case, the main target
in the real case,
the person who was at the heart of that, he's actually
in the show, isn't he?
In the show
later on.
Yeah, he shows up, I think, in season three.
He's the preacher.
He's
right?
the priest. Yeah. So yeah, he's
you can't see it, but I'm just shaking my head.
Shaking his head.
Come on!
I can't think of the name, but We'll put them in the show notes.
That's right. I forgot about that.
And then, so that's one layer to it. And then another one that I think is endlessly fascinating is there's a character later on, who I think She first shows up in season 3, I think, but really doesn't become a fixture until season 4.
Snoop.
And that's Snoop. Snoop, who is portrayed by Felicia Snoop Pearson.
Yeah.
And the character Snoop is this sort of she's like a street warrior.
Yep.
That's the best way to, you know, to say it. She's she's sort of a hit person.
Yeah.
Hit
girl. She's a I think the
term, a mercenary.
She's like a lieutenant of one of the, you know, the drug lords. She's one of the main, like, this third in command almost.
Yeah.
In a way. Not really command, but just like this, you know, Marlo, who is one of the drug lords, mm-hmm. has two sort of right hand people.
Right.
Or I guess his right hand person is Chris Partlow, mm-hmm. and Chris's right hand person is Snoop. So she's kind of third in line.
Yeah. But she's a really a deceptively cold character, and it's even crazier that the person playing her was actually
from the streets of Baltimore.
Right, from the streets of Baltimore, and spent time incarcerated for manslaughter, like secondary manslaughter, I think.
She was not an actress.
No. And that is part of what's so so compelling about the show, is that like this fascinating culture that doesn't necessarily make any sense sometimes, but it's so bizarrely fascinating. You sort of want to know more about it. And there's another thing, like nothing is necessarily explained outright.
Yeah.
Especially in the early shows, in the early seasons, there are things you're just sort of expected to pick up on eventually. Yeah. They're not going to define terms to you.
You know,
there's street language that's used that unless you spend time on the street, you don't necessarily know. You don't have a dictionary that explains it.
It's impressive how little exposition there is.
Yeah.
It's like straight exposition.
Yeah.
There's a lot of it just in the activities of the show. Like as the show goes on, you pick it up, you know, and you get a little piece here and a little piece there about like what, you know, certain terms mean and how this system works and stuff like that. But it's never like, no one ever sits down and says, oh, well, you know, when they say this is what they mean.
Like, you don't have the scene where like a rookie cop comes in and the grizzled old veteran is like, well, when?
Yeah.
When he says donuts, what it's he your means first is a punch in your face. You know,
it's your first day, kid. I'm going to walk you up there with the ropes. There's no, the learning curve is steep.
Yeah.
But it's rewarding.
Yeah.
You mentioned Snoop, and she is one of the most like incredible characters from fiction in the past, I don't know, 50 years. I just pulled that
since
number
the
out
history
of
fiction.
But she is, right? Like, I've never seen a character like that ever.
Yeah.
Ever. And there's a few characters on The Wire who I'm like, I had no template for.
Yeah, there's no precedent for that person.
Right.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not cultured enough. Maybe I haven't read enough or seen enough.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're there and I just don't know about them. But for me, it was, you know, like these are characters I've never seen.
Yeah.
And it was really, that's what's really rewarding about it, is it feels very new and very fresh.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of ballsy, the fact that, you know, like David Simon was able to get all of these people involved. And this comes up later, I think, and especially fascinating with his relationship to the city itself and some of the officials that were governing it as the show's being made. Yeah. And it has since, you know, I'm sure none of this stuff was really like publicly acknowledged at the time, but it's really interesting to see characters who are clearly inspired by real life people or real life circumstances. And then to find out that the interactions with the creative team on the show and these individuals actually, in a lot of ways, they sort of they kind of mirror that tension that's on the show. You know, there's one of the, we'll say one of the politician characters in the show.
Which one? Just say it. Just say the name.
Carchetti.
You can talk about names.
All right, Carchetti. Carchetti is
there's a character on the show.
There's a guy. Well, I don't know.
He's a male.
How much do we want to talk about?
He's got hair.
See, the thing is, I don't know if this is interesting to say these characters' names if you don't know the show.
Well, I mean, for those who do know the show, we can talk.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's going to be confusing if you don't, if you just say there's a guy.
There's a man who breathes air.
He's on the wire.
He drives a car.
Carchetti.
So Carchetti is a politician who is seemingly always moving forward, always looking for like mm-hmm. another, looking to make another step,
yep.
you know, up the chain or whatever. And the actual mayor of Baltimore at the time that the show was being made was sort of following a yeah. similar trajectory.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much that overlapped and how much one inspired the other, but it's really interesting to find out sort of after the fact that when the show started becoming recognized, like after mm-hmm. the first couple seasons, and when it was clear that this was not necessarily an always favorable portrait of the city,
yeah.
how quickly like the tables turned on the producers and like the city wanted absolutely nothing to yeah, do with the yeah, show and yeah. like wanted it completely shut down or you know, removed from the Baltimore.
Yep.
The association with Baltimore completely removed.
Yeah. Good luck.
Which is bizarre because I mean, if anything, it's not, I don't feel like it is saying anything we wouldn't necessarily automatically assume
yeah.
if we were thinking the worst about a city, you know, if yeah. you're, if you already have in your mind the notion that of sort of civic failure, you yeah. know, or, you know, the breakdown of a city, I feel like this, it's not painting a worse picture.
No.
If anything, it's creating a more eloquent understanding of why things are the way they are.
Yes.
It's not necessarily explaining away everything or saying like this, you know, it's okay that things are this way
no,
because
yeah.
this is this yeah, way. Yeah, yeah. But I feel like I've never seen a show that helped me understand things in the way that The Wire does, to the point that I don't know why anybody would ever necessarily shy away from it, from being associated with it, you know.
I guess
what I'm saying is I don't think it paints a worse picture of no. Baltimore than somebody could
may
paint
have
themselves
already assumed.
Right. Yeah.
There's no revelations of like, oh, things are so bad, or it's not like you're surprised by a corrupt politician
right.
or how dangerous the streets may be, you
right.
know, like none of that. And they don't present it as though you should be surprised.
Yeah.
Like that everyone, it seems it's very evident, you know, you go into this assuming, yeah, the, you know, crime is bad. The streets, there's a lot of tragedy. Politicians are corrupt. The police are somewhat corrupt.
Right.
You know, like
there's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot
yeah,
of,
you have all of these assumptions going into it, and it simply uses those assumptions to present to you, like you know, these things, you assume them to be true. And in many cases they are true, but here's why they
right.
are true.
Like, and there's more to it than
yeah,
just the fact that it is what it is.
It's not
yeah.
simple. It's not simply like this guy wants to be continually succeed in politics. Like this guy just mm-hmm. wants to go up the chain. There's a reason for that.
Right.
You know, there's, and here's what that reasoning is. You know, yes, the streets are tragic, but here's why. Like, and it's not really for the reasons you may think.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the surprises come,
mm-hmm.
is in the explanation behind those things.
I'll swallow a lie when I have to. I've swallowed a few big ones lately. But the stacked games, that lie, it's what ruined this department. Shining up shit and calling it gold so majors become colonels and mayors become governors. Pretending to do police work while one generation fucking trains the next town not to do the job. And then... I looked Carcetti in the eye. I shook his hand. I asked him if he was for real. Well, this is the lie I can't live with. If I do, then Nerissa has me in her pocket whenever she wants me. And I'm no good to anyone like that.
Then go. Withdraw for personal reasons or health reasons. Whatever. You've got your law degree. You're not gonna starve. But if you don't go, they'll wreck both of us.
There's not enough in here to indict me. And the joke of it is, I've seen enough the last few days to have them indicted.
I think that the most startling picture that's painted is of the bureaucracy in the police department.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where I think there was the most obfuscation previously. Like, I think everyone kind of has assumptions based on like crime and drugs and politicians and schools. But I think a lot of people don't have a clear picture of what, you know, police bureaucracy and administration is all about, mm-hmm. and like what drives them to do the things they do, what drives, you know, a police officer on an individual level, and what drives that system, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and that, I think that's the most of everything you learn. To me, that was the most illuminating.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, you want it to be the police are there because they want to do good.
Right.
You want that. You want it to be altruistic.
And you want it to work, you know, yeah. you want like, okay, they've got experience at this, it, you know, we, yeah. it's not like we don't know how to do our jobs, you know, yeah. it's why.
And you are unfortunately reminded that police officers are people who are like, you know, they run the gamut of good people and bad people and doing things for the right reasons versus the wrong reasons, or whether that's even a thing, like, are there right reasons and wrong reasons right. to do anything?
Yeah. What does that even mean?
Like, and I think, I read an interview with David Simon who was talking about some of the best cops are not good cops because they want to do the right thing, that they want, you know, crime to or criminals to pay,
mm-hmm.
that they want just to see justice served. They're good cops because they have huge egos and they don't want to be outsmarted or outdone by criminals. Like, it's all in their ego.
Mm.
It is not a sense of like, this is the right thing. This person deserves justice.
It's like they want, it's the like personal
you
victory.
Dare, you know, like you dare to presume you're smarter than me, that I can't figure out your game, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that's, it's both upsetting and awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
that's kind of like, that's the show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's upsetting
and
in a multitude
no one
of ways,
exemplifies that role more than McNulty.
No.
Who is both the most like incredible character to follow and the most frustrating character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it's funny how other characters talk about McNulty, you know, they, mm-hmm. they're like, he's the best detective. You know, if you want, you know, a case to get cleared, put McNulty on it,
mm-hmm.
but he's the, you know, the biggest asshole any of them has ever met. He's, you know, his life is screwed up and it's because of him that
right.
it's screwed up. You know, he makes the worst decisions and it's, you know, that.
And he's virtually impossible to work with too.
Yes.
Like, that's the other thing.
It's everyone he works with gets really angry at him.
Yeah.
Like, and it's funny to see people who, you know, as the show goes, new characters interact with him. And at first they're like, kind of like, enchanted by him,
yeah,
in a way they're like, wow, what a, you know, he's an amazing cop and he's so determined and tenacious,
yeah,
and then by the end of it they're like, you were such an asshole. Like, it's all about you, there's no, you know, no one else matters in your world.
Yeah.
There's like a line where, what's the line, it's something like everything you touch turns to shit or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
And it's really incredible.
It's funny, like, and you kind of get the, maybe this is the point where we sort of go into more detail.
Should we stop?
Let's,
okay.
Yeah, let's say
from this point
on, we're probably going to get into
if
some.
If you have never seen The Wire, go home, pause, hit pause on the.
They probably already are at home.
Okay.
Listen to this.
Or you're in your car.
In the car. Yeah.
Or you're at work.
Yeah. Leave work.
But hold on. Pause.
I think you're coming down with something.
Pause the podcast. Put put a bookmark in it. Go home. If you're already home, stay there. Mm-hmm. Or go out and get all five seasons somehow.
They're available.
I've got them. If you want to borrow them, I will loan them to you. I'm actually rewatching it right now.
So you can't watch them right now.
You can't. But although you may be listening to this long after I finish them, just ask me. I've got all five seasons. I will loan them to you. Watch all five seasons. Remove all the food from your refrigerator. Then come back and hit play, because we're gonna all bets are off now. We will talk about everything that has happened in the show. There, we will be spoiling everything from this point on. John's gonna put in a break here, some kind of like audio thing.
Yeah.
And when we come back from the audio thing, we're gonna divulge every secret of The Wire.
Yeah.
So this is your chance. Run away. Go watch the show.
If you walk through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the stealing their sight. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil.
You've watched it.
You're back. You watched it.
You watched the show.
Man, you probably need to go to the grocery store, because all your food is probably spoiled.
You've been taking a shower.
Why did we say to take the food out of the fridge? Anyway?
You said that. I don't know why. When I was relaying the story of Diana and Ted telling me to watch the show, what you added to that story was, they told me to remove all the food from my refrigerator.
So, all right. So you're hungry, or maybe you're full.
We don't care.
Because you ate everything.
It's a
what are the point? Just is you watch something. The show. Yeah. Shut up about the food. Watch the show.
Season one is about the streets and the police.
And the police. And our window into that is,
it's the primer. It's, or the primer, whatever pronunciation. Nobody says primer. Some people do.
Oh, get out of here, people. Stop. Go away. I don't want your patronage. Primers.
It's the primer for this, for systems, really.
Yeah.
Well, the show is about systems. I just realized that.
The show is about systems.
Okay, so there are two systems presented to you in season one, and fleshed out.
Fleshed.
The streets and the police. And both are equally screwed up.
Yeah.
but you sort of follow the trajectory of the police in that McNulty sees D'Angelo Barksdale he's cleared. His name is cleared of murder.
He's acquitted.
Acquitted of murder. And he's guilty. He is guilty.
Right.
And you know that he is. He admits as much on the show at a certain point. So there's no questioning it. But the way the system works, he's acquitted. And that makes McNulty mad. It challenges his ego, right?
Because he busted him, didn't he?
Did he bust him? I don't know if he did, actually.
Maybe not.
But D'Angelo was like the third of several people who had been acquitted or who had, you know, the charges had been cleared or what have you when McNulty knew that they were guilty.
Right.
You know, so his ego is challenged. He goes to a judge that he knows and he's like, you know, this guy just made a joke of the system.
Yeah.
And so that kind of is the catalyst for the rest of, I mean, rest of the series in a way, yeah. But for season one, that begins the investigation into D'Angelo's uncle, Avon Barksdale, who is the, I guess, the most powerful drug lord in Baltimore at the time.
You don't really have a sense of,
I mean, at the time you don't really know,
like in terms of the city itself, because it really is more or less just his organization that's kind of the focus of that first season. You don't really see too much beyond it. You get a little hint of something coming out of New York.
The city itself is broken up into sections. There's West Baltimore,
right,
and East Baltimore, which are kind of like two different territories.
Mm-hmm. And Avon is west.
Yeah,
he's the west.
You don't learn a whole lot about East in the first season.
No.
You get glimpses, but not a whole lot.
Yeah.
But anyway, you learn about the way the streets work through the wiretap that is then through the investigation that McNulty kind of kicks off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's his sort of maddening quest for self-fulfillment that is kind of what leads to any kind of breakthrough in the show. It's sort of like you get the sense that, like, until he pushes the right people's buttons,
until he pisses the right people off,
exactly, it's pretty much business as usual, and no one is really making a concerted effort to bust this organization. You know,
totally.
You get the sense that it's like, it's whenever a body shows up, they investigate it until they can clear it and get it off their wall.
Yeah.
You know, or the same thing with the drug bust.
Keep the numbers lower than the year before
or
close to, they're kind of, you know, they're fine.
As long as they can satisfy some threshold or some sort of requirement that's placed upon them by their superiors.
Yeah.
They're not going to rock the boat. Nobody's really pursuing anything.
But McNulty, as we said before, does not want to be, does not want his ego challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And when it is, that's when he starts like pushing buttons and trying to make people do things that he wants them to do so that he can fulfill his own ends, you know, in a way. Mm-hmm. Right. Season one,
which he, in a way, and I think this, there's an interesting mirror later on that we can talk about, but in a way I feel like he really does believe he is doing like what the organization would do if it just weren't so messed up.
Yes.
You know, he really feels like he's not insanely driven, you know, by his own goals. I think he really does think like this is what police do, or what police are supposed to do.
Police.
This is what police are supposed to do. They just don't know it.
Yes.
You know, they're just not aware of it.
Yeah. In his mind, there's like seven good police in the Baltimore, you know, police department. He's one of them, and the rest of them aren't doing their jobs right.
Yeah.
And it's up to him to get them to do their jobs right. Whether they're his superiors or not, you know, like he will challenge the highest up person in his organization if he thinks they're not doing their job.
Yeah.
Season one has one of the best scenes of the whole series in it, in my opinion. And that is the chess scene.
Yeah.
All right, man. Now look, check it. It's simple. See this? This the kingpin, all right? And he the man. You get the other dude's king, you got the game. And he trying to get your king too, so you got protected. Now the king, he move one space any direction he damn choose, because he's the king. Like this, all right? But he ain't got no hustle. But the rest of these motherfuckers on the team, they got his back. And they run so deep, he really ain't got to do shit.
I like your uncle.
Yeah, like my uncle. And you see this? This the queen. She's smart, she fierce. She move any way she want, as far as she want. And she is the go get shit done piece.
Remind me of Stringer.
And this over here is the castle. It's like the stash. He moved like this, and like this.
Dog, stash don't move, man.
Come on, yo, think. How many times we moved the stash house this week? Right? And every time we move the stash, we gotta move a little muscle with it, right? To protect it.
True. True. You right. All right. What about them little bald-headed bitches right there?
All right, these right here, these are the pawns. They like the soldiers. They move like this, one space forward only, except when they fight. And it's like this. And they like the front lines. They be out in the field.
So how do you get to be the king?
It ain't like that. See, the king, stay the king, all right? Everything stay who he is.
And what I love about the character D'Angelo is how he surprises you in his wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
Like he understand, like he doesn't even realize how well he understands things, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you see him sort of over the course of season one and two understanding how the system works and how the fact that he can't win in the system.
Yeah, season one is in a lot of ways him coming to terms with that realization. Yeah.
But that, I think that is one of the best scenes, not only in the show, but in television.
Yeah.
It's so good. And it seems so simple, too. Like, it's one of those scenes where you're like, why hasn't this been written before?
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like sort of an obvious metaphor when you think about it, but it really...
But it's articulated so well.
Yeah.
And the it's acted very well.
Yeah.
All three of those actors are really good.
Yeah.
Especially in that scene. The best, Bodhi, is one of my favorite characters of the series.
Yeah.
And it's his, to follow, like, his trajectory in that show is so awesome. Like, he's another character who slowly understands, like, how things work and sees that he can't succeed in the, you know.
Yeah.
He can get to a certain point, but that's it.
Yeah.
And he won't ever get any further in life if he stays in that organization.
And his frustration, I think, throughout the series is really... He's a really great person to watch over that evolution. You know, you really do sort of watch him grow up. You realize it later on, like, you know, just how young he was when you first meet him.
It's he's one of the characters that I feel like initially I think you kind of write him off.
Yeah. Like as just a street thug or something.
And there's a few characters in the show that initially you're like, this guy's not really worth much, and I'm not, you know, he's not gonna do a whole lot in this show, but later become like one of the most interesting I think important characters of the show. Another one's Carver. I think Carver is a really good character to follow his arc through the whole series.
It's interesting because Bodhi, his stature within the organization does not change at all, throughout the course of
He gets up, he moves up a little bit.
A tiny bit, yeah. But for the most part, he's still working the corner, you know.
And
he's
especially
still...
when the Barksdale organization crumbles,
yeah,
he loses all imports, all like power. Yeah. He's basically beholden to whoever's got the power.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
He has no seniority at that point.
Any chance he had for advancement is gone once the Barksdale organization crumbles.
Yeah. But Carver, it's interesting, like Carver is he changes too, like internally.
Yeah.
You sort of watch his character internally develop.
Yeah.
But in addition to that, he's also, I think, one of the few who seems to actually capitalize on those changes, like professionally.
It's actually kind of his success in the show seems not undeserved, but like he shouldn't have been successful.
Yeah,
because he is one of the characters who, after a certain point, I think like season three. At the end of season three, when I think Randy, his house burns down
or
whatever.
Season four.
Oh, is it season four?
That was four with the Randy, yeah.
So, well, something... So season four is when Carver becomes a good police officer.
Yeah.
From the beginning of season four on.
Yeah.
Like something, I can't think of what it is
happens. Clear. At the beginning of season four, you recognize that he knows his beat.
Exactly. Like,
he knows these kids.
He's taken the time to understand the street. Like, he's not going out there just to enjoy pounding on kids anymore.
Yeah.
Like he's doing police work.
Yeah.
And from that point on, he's doing, I guess what could be called the right thing in a lot of cases, you know, he feels morally right in a lot of ways. And usually that isn't rewarded in the show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Usually you kind of stay where you are if you're doing that, or you get demoted.
Yeah.
And he, by season five, becomes a lieutenant.
Yeah.
At the very end, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting to see that you can, in some cases, be successful without playing the game. Because he decides not to play the game.
Yeah.
There's a moment where, is it season, I think it is season one, where Daniels calls Carver in his office and he's like, you know, I've been trying to figure out this whole investigation, who the leak is. I know someone's been leaking information to Burrell or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he figures out that it's Carver. Carver's been leaking information about what the investigation is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniels basically lays it down. He's like, you're going to have to decide if you're going to play the game or if you're going to be good police, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because at that point, it seems like Carver decides he's going to play the game.
Yeah.
And it isn't until later that he makes the other decision.
Yeah.
But he's an amazing character to follow
great.
Through that show.
He's great. And the one scene, like the, before we leave Carver and Bodie, I have to talk about that one scene. I think it's season one where Herc and Carver are out at a movie.
I think it's season three.
Is it really?
It might be. It's either two or three.
Okay. That's later. But yeah, he and Herc are out at a movie.
One of the best scenes.
And they've got their dates with them and they come out of the theater and they walk over and they run into Bodie
and Poot.
And Poot, who both have their dates with them.
They're like, they go, hey, like Bodie and Poot play it off like, oh, it's our old buddies.
Right. These are our guys.
And the girls are like, who's that? And I think Bodie says, oh, we work with them.
Yeah.
See you guys tomorrow.
Yeah.
And like the look on Herc and Carver's faces are priceless.
Yeah.
It's so cool. I think it's one of those moments you never like would have thought about until understanding like the structure of the police and, you know, like everyday criminals that they interact with every day, and like to see them outside of, it's like when you see your teacher outside of school, it makes no sense and you don't know what to do, you know, and that's clearly what they're feeling at that point.
But there's still like, it's almost like there is that sense of ownership. Like, you know, like these are my guys.
Great. Well, and that's kind of reflected later on when Carver has become better police, and he's doing his beat, and he goes out and he kind of talks to the kids, and you know, he gives them a hard time, and he's like, "Oh, me and Bodie, we go way back, blah blah blah," you know, and he isn't just like I think he does rough them up in the scene, but he also like has a rapport with them that he didn't have.
Yeah.
Like there's,
they respect him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a respect there that wasn't there.
Yeah.
Which is really cool.
Yeah.
So season one ends with, Barksdale busted for,
I think, isn't it conspiracy?
Something like that
related. I forget what they pin on him, but well, it's, yeah, they, cause they hear him, they catch him admitting to, something. We should have watched the show before.
I know.
But yeah, he gets busted,
and he's put in jail.
Yeah.
The D'Angelo's in jail too.
Right.
Because D'Angelo, he gets arrested and try to get him to turn on the you know, on Avon, but
right.
he doesn't in the end.
Yeah.
But he still, so he gets, ends up getting years on him.
Yeah.
Like he could have gotten out in like 5 years or something, and instead he gets 20 because he doesn't talk.
Right.
And Stringer Bell is left, you know, free.
Right.
He does
they
not,
don't have anything on Stringer Bell. Who we haven't even talked about. We haven't talked about Stringer Bell yet.
Stringer
but,
Bell.
Yeah. So Stringer is.
Well, hold on. So. Because I know where this is going to go places if we start talking about Stringer Bell. But season one is actually, for me, was like the ending was a letdown, not in the sense that I was like, oh, what a, you know, I don't like this show anymore. But it seemed like the wiretap was unsuccessful. Like, they didn't get the people for the things they were supposed to get them for. Stringer right. Bell is not arrested. You know, you feel like, oh, all that work, and it seems like they didn't do it right.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Which is, I think, is what's great about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because it does, it feels so realistic, but it's also, I think it places you firmly within the scale of the show, like, yeah, what you're going to get out of the show. It is, yeah, a perfect introduction to the show at large, that,
yes,
whole season is.
Yes.
Because it doesn't necessarily play out the way you want it to or the way you expect it to. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you can see why, like, you appreciate things, I think, more so because there has been such a hard fight for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they don't make a huge leap. There are no remarkable accomplishments made in that first season.
Yeah.
But you feel like you've really covered ground, mm-hmm, you know, in that first season, I think.
I agree. It's 10, 12 episodes?
Yeah.
I think it seems like there's so much that happens,
yeah,
and yet it's such a seemingly short number of episodes.
Yeah.
Stringer Bell. Season two starts, right? And
yeah.
Stringer Bell is now kind of in charge of the Barksdale organization while Avon's in jail.
Right.
But so that's a good place to talk about Stringer Bell.
Stringer Bell, who has, he's sort of defined, I think, by his differences from Avon.
Yes,
you know,
he's which
very
are
much
highlighted to a great degree in season three.
Yeah,
but
yeah, it comes to the forefront,
yeah,
in season three, but it's implied, I think, more in season one and two, where, you know, Avon is very much the ethos of the street. I think,
yeah,
you know,
he believes in the street.
Yeah,
like the rules of the street. He believes he is. A follower of, like, the way things have been done,
yeah,
in the street, you know, since people can remember.
Yeah. He's like sort of tradition personified.
Yes.
Yeah. Whereas Stringer, who you come to realize over the course of a couple of seasons, was sort of, he grew up with Avon.
Yep.
The two of them sort of plotted this whole thing out,
yeah,
as kids, you know, the sort of growing up in this, in the projects, and kind of looking toward the future, you know, that they wanted to have,
mm-hmm,
you know, where they were going to control the trade, and they ultimately have come to do that. They've realized that.
Yeah.
And that's really all that Avon wants.
Yeah.
You know, he
wants to control his part of Baltimore.
Right. He wants the west side of Baltimore,
yeah,
the drug trade in the west side of Baltimore. Stringer, on the other hand, has grander sights. And I don't really know when it becomes clear. I guess you could sort of see it in early seasons when you find out that there's a great scene where McNulty is sort of tailing him and finds him in a community college classroom,
yes,
which,
oh,
is,
man,
it's one of those defining moments of the series where you're sort of confronted with the fact that these are not characters that can be defined by one trade.
Yeah.
You know, like, not every person involved in the drug trade is simply a street pusher.
Yeah.
You know, that there is,
you can't write them off.
Right, exactly.
And, yeah, McNulty's tailing him, like, the whole day. He's,
yeah,
like, he takes a day and just kind of follows Stringer Bell around.
Yeah.
I think it might be season two.
Maybe. I thought it was earlier than that, but yeah.
I don't think it
could be.
Is it season one?
I feel like it is.
Well, anyway, he eventually tails him to a community college, and he's like, what's he doing here? You know, and
yeah,
he walks in, and he's sort of looking in classrooms, and then through that little window and a door, he sees Stringer Bell sitting in class taking notes, and you're,
yeah,
like, you have the same reaction as McNulty, where you're like, what?
Yeah, you're like, this doesn't fit.
Yeah.
This doesn't fit my picture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think if Avon is, you know, embodies tradition,
mm-hmm,
in the streets, Stringer embodies this desire to legitimize the streets, like to apply business reasoning and acumen to the organization of the street. You know, he sees that a system is there. And what he doesn't understand is, you know, why don't we approach this like any other business, you know,
like professionals?
Yeah. Yeah. This is how, if we want to be successful, if we want to get further in life, then we need to apply these skills. And so he starts to apply business.
Macroeconomics, basically.
It's incredible. Like in season three, I think he starts having these sit down meetings with all his lieutenants and his, you know, the heads of his corners. And
yeah, they're like strategy meetings. Yeah.
He's like, here's, you know, here's what we're going to do today. And you're not supposed to speak unless you raise your hand. And, you know, and it's really funny when like that system he's trying to, you know, employ kind of breaks down a bit, and you see sort of the street come through when he gets, you know, even in him, of like, you know, yelling and getting angry, and it's
acting actually, impulsively.
Yeah. You also, he eventually forms a co-op.
Yeah.
Like he gets all the drug lords of Baltimore together, and they're like, here's what we need to do. We should all work together to get the best product, and then we'll all make money, you know, rather than like being at each other's throats.
Yeah.
It's just protecting, incredible, like what he these does.
Mini fiefdoms. Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's sort of like, and this is particularly true in St. Louis, I think, where we have so many of these miniature municipalities that are sort of, you know, they have their own police force, their own, you know, city halls or whatever like that. You sort of have that kind of construct in Philadelphia among the Baltimore among the drug trade, where you've got, you know, everybody sort of defending their own territory and not wanting to let go of that, and Stringer kind of really being in a lot of ways a lot like McNulty, because he sort of sees it, you know, this, he can't, he what he sees, what he's compelled to do, he believes is for the good of all of these organizations. You know, it's not just
in like, for the good of his, I think he actually thinks it's good for the city.
He probably does. Yeah. He thinks he's
like
he's actually improving the city.
He sees the drug trade as a legitimate part of what makes the city work.
Yeah.
And so he's trying to make it stronger, you know, like he's trying to make it work well.
Yeah. More efficiently, to where there, it's not dragged down by sort of the street practices that,
because does he say at one point, he's like, the less bodies we're making, the less police are messing with us.
Right.
So if we work together and cut down on the murders, we can make money, and we, you know, the police won't be trying to interfere all the time.
Yeah, they're
they
not
don't care. And somebody makes a statement: the police don't care about the drugs.
Right.
Like.
The drugs don't show up.
Yeah.
They're not accountable for the drugs.
Exactly.
Nobody knows if 1,000 people are doing drugs or 1,000,000 people are doing drugs.
But one person gets killed.
Right. When a body shows up in a newspaper, and it's
a white body, usually.
Yeah. Yeah. The police are held accountable for it. Yeah. So
the talking about Stringer makes it makes me think of Prop Joe, who is the East Side sort of drug lord.
Yeah.
Who I think the interesting thing about Prop Joe and kind of his crew is you see it's your glimpse into the fact that the Barksdale organization is not unique. That like these little, like you said, fiefdoms almost exist in a lot of places, and that everyone has sort of a similar structure of, you know, there's the head guy, he's kind of got his right hand person, and then there are the lieutenants underneath them, you know, and it's neat to see that reflected in other areas. And eventually you have Marlowe show up on the scene and you see his version of that. And so, you know, if Avon's tradition and Stringer is like kind of trying to legitimize, what Marlowe's like the chaotic kind of he really doesn't seem to want to stand up for anything
in a way. He doesn't really stand for any kind of tradition.
Yeah.
You know, he's sort of the...
But he's also not interested in the business part.
Yeah. He actively works to undo the co-op.
Yeah.
You know, sort of...
I think maybe he just wants power.
Yeah.
I think it... Like, Avon wants money and success. I think Stringer wants acclaim.
Yeah.
And Marlo wants power. You know, Marlo wants to be the one that everyone fears.
I think, yeah, that's it. I think Marlo really just wants everyone to be afraid of
him. Yeah, his name. Like, he wants his name to have power, right? Yeah. Like, because his organization seems small. Mm-hmm. All from the moment he's introduced to the end.
Yeah.
It seems like he keeps a really close organization, but a powerful one.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, he's kind of the most powerful. Because Barksdale's crumbled. He breaks up the co-op. He kills Prop Joe. You know, he kind of like gets rid of the power players and becomes, you know, the sort of biggest guy on the scene. And then he starts to take a trajectory that Stringer Bell was taking.
Mm-hmm.
In that... he starts talking to the, you know, lawyers and real estate people, and it's clear that eventually he's like, this is not what I'm in this for. Yeah. You know, and he
has a very visceral reaction to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a great note for him to end his character on.
Season two is the docs.
The docs. Yeah. And
I think a lot of people consider season two to be the least interesting of the seasons,
which is really interesting because I think
it's the most unique.
Yeah. If there is a side of the city that is perhaps less well known than the drug trade or, you know, the inner workings of the police.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a large part, I feel like it's the most interesting season because it gives you a glimpse into a world that you know even less about than, you know, you do about the drug trade or, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the docks and the union and the sort of, I guess you would call it like the blue collar working class kind of.
I think one of the purposes of the second season is to show you where the drugs come from.
Mm-hmm.
Like who supplies all of this to Baltimore.
Right. How does it get to Baltimore?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also give you a glimpse into you season one and 3 through 5, you understand, or you are educated primarily on the black community.
Mm-hmm.
In the streets, and season two is where you get a sense of what sort of the poor white community is like and sort of what they go through. And so they focus it on these dock workers.
And also I think too, sort of how that side of things is changing too, along with the, you know, the street, like the shakeups within the Barksdale organization. Mm-hmm. It's in a way, I feel like that's sort of, it's sort of saying like this kind of structure is ending, you know? And then season two comes in and it sort of says, this is sort of the other side of that, you know, wherein what there was an established, precedent that's sort of been kind of at the heart of labor in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't work anymore,
yeah.
You know, for various reasons. And they sort of tease, the great thing about the series, I think as a whole, is that as you get toward the end of one season, you start to
see glimpses.
You start
of
to
the
blend,
next.
Yeah. It does. It's not kind of a hard stop and start. You know, there's a little bit of an overlap there,
yeah.
And that's kind of like as you're coming into season two, you start to get a taste of that. And especially, I think between season two and season three, there's more of a fusing of politics, which is what the kind of at the heart of season three is the political side, and you see how at the end of season two, you sort of see how that association with politicians has, you see why it's how it's worked, and you see how it's failed.
Yeah,
and I don't know. I think that there are moments in season two that I think are probably some of the most emotional of the whole show, like, the whole series. For example, Frank Sabatka, who is kind of the, I guess, the lead character on the docks.
Yeah.
And he has, in the way that Barksdale has kind of devoted his life to the streets, and you know, he's given everything he has to the streets and expected really nothing more than the streets to
can give
to, well, yeah, and expected nothing out of them beyond what he feels he's been promised.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
He sort of has there's like an implicit agreement there, I think, in Avon, that he doesn't push himself beyond what the streets can give him, and he doesn't expect anything more than that.
Yep.
And you sort of get the same thing from Sabatka, wherein he's not like living a rich man's life.
No.
You know, he lives in a pretty modest home. Mm-hmm. He has a modest family, but he's the head of this organization, this Teamsters group.
Yep.
And
Stevedores.
The Stevedores. And
is it Stevedores or Steve Doors?
I don't know. I always call it Steve Doors just because it sounds fun. I don't know. But, you know, he's been like a dock worker his whole life. Yeah. And that's, you get that impression based on like all of his interactions with people. Mm-hmm. He has like sort of this established crew, and he's very well ensconced in that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And over the course of the season, you start to realize that what he feels, you know, he's sort of bought into this pact with that organization, with this construct, and for a variety of factors, that is no longer the union, that lifestyle is no longer living up to what he has bought into.
It's in decline.
Yeah.
Like that structure and that system has lost the power it had.
Yeah.
And it's no longer relevant to the city overall. And so those who would have sort of played up to Sabatka, those who he would have expected favors from or would have expected, you know, a return on his investment in the docks from, they don't have a reason to give him what he wants anymore.
Right. It probably comes a lot from knowing that David Simon grew up in Baltimore, you know, and knows that scene. But you can kind of feel, I think, in season two, there's a very forlorn approach to that, you know, where, and I feel like he's even said something in an interview, you know, talking about how the show is, it's about a lot of things, but it's in a lot of ways, it is about kind of the end of the American empire.
Yeah.
And I think that is probably most poignantly portrayed in season two.
Yeah.
Thanks for waiting, Brucey son.
Frank, I shouldn't even be seen with you at this point.
I just want to settle our business while we still have the chance.
Frank.
Because it ain't like I'm going to get my hands on a whole lot more cash for obvious reasons.
Frank, the grain pier is dead. Half the votes we had lined up are walking sideways now. They read the paper, Frank.
So what? So I'm dirty. The grain pier's still the grain pier, right? They ain't voting for me, Brucey. It ain't about me.
I'm not going to lie, Frank. No one is going to stand with us now that the FBI is on you. They're scared.
Of what?
They took the money, Frank. And now they deliver the votes, they figure the feds are going to be on them, too. I'm sorry, Frank. Look, you find a way of putting this FBI thing to bed, and then maybe we can come back the next session with the grain pier. All right? You'll have a couple of people down there knowing they owe you a vote or two. I don't know what else to say. I don't. Sorry, Frank.
You know what the trouble is, Brucey? We used to make shit in this country, build shit. Now we just put our hand in the next guy's pocket.
And I feel like that, the end of season two really kind of hammers that idea home. And it sort of, in a way, it kind of says, like, this is your last chance. Like, if you, this is the point at which, if you can't handle this concept of being deflated and being let down by pretty much everybody, don't watch the rest of this show.
It's, you know, and the more we talk about it, the more I understand why that season feels like such an anomaly, you know, because it's the least revisited of the seasons. Like, you, the characters from season two, many of them you don't really see.
Yeah.
And like, you get like one or two show up in an episode. Like, Nick shows up, I think, in season five.
Yeah.
Like,
briefly.
For
like, basically a cameo. Yeah.
And you're just like, oh, it's, what's his face?
Yeah, you're so excited to see him, though.
and like, one of the dock workers is homeless in season five. He's one of the homeless guys.
Oh, yeah.
But what I've realized just now when you talking about it is, like, that just proves, like, that they are no longer relevant.
Yeah.
Like, that part of the city doesn't matter to the city anymore.
Yeah.
And so that's why you don't hear about them from that point on, really.
Yeah.
Like, there's no reason to go back.
Sort of, that's the end of it. Yeah. It's the swan song for them. Yeah.
So it's then season three is where we get into the politics of the city, right?
Mm-hmm.
On a very kind of ground level with Carchetti and Gray and there's just that they're like councilmen. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really interesting to see, like, the power that just these councilmen have over, you know, police department or what have you.
Oh, yeah.
And then how they start to kind of, you know, work their way up the chain. And you see, you know, Carchetti realizing he has a chance to run for mayor and, like, what his platform could be and stuff like that. He is the weirdest character on the show. And I didn't know, you know, when I was watching it, I didn't know he was Irish. The actor is Irish.
Uh-huh.
And I always thought, God, he's got such a weird accent. Like, I've never heard anyone who sounds like this. And then when I found out he was Irish, I was like, oh, okay, he can't do an American accent.
His Irish just keeps pouring out whenever he gets really
season
angry.
Season three is also where the Avon and Stringer thing comes to a head.
Yeah.
And where they become very aware of how different they are from one another.
Yeah.
And there's the great scene where they're out, you know, looking at Baltimore at night. They're, you know, on some, like, deck.
They're, like, downtown in, like, this really ritzy part of sort of a revitalized urban area.
They're successful. Yeah. They've got money. The, you know, organization is doing well. And it's clear they have this conversation where they both know that the other has betrayed him.
If you imagine, man, if I had the money that I have now, man, I could have bought half this waterfront property. God damn it. Yeah, forget about that for a while, man. You know, just dream with me. You ain't got to dream no more, man. You got real shit. Real estate. We could touch.
You know, and I've never, it's just such a great kind of moment of the overall series. And it's a really nice cap to that storyline.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course later, Omar and Brother Muzon find Stringer Bell and kill him and team up. And
I can't believe we haven't even talked about
there's
Omar
a lot of characters
at this point,
we haven't
but,
talked
yeah.
about.
But Omar, I think, the chief among them, being like the ones who...
The hardest to pin down.
Yeah.
The most surprising
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways. He's like, he's one of those characters that you root for and you kind of feel bad for rooting for him because he kills. But then you're like, but he's killing drug dealers. Then you're like, but then a lot
you
of the,
try to rationalize to yourself,
but
why
there's
you're...
really no rationale. And I think, well, it comes down to, my friend Diana made this point, you know, the people that you tend to like on the show are the people who have a code, you know, and then Omar says it himself, like, man's got to have a code, or maybe Bunk says that. It's a conversation between Bunk and Omar in like season one. Where one of them said a man's got to have a code. And so the characters who live by a code, you know, you tend to respect.
Yeah.
And Omar is definitely one of those characters.
Yeah.
Who he doesn't hurt innocent people or citizens. He only hurts drug dealers.
Yeah.
And takes their money.
Yeah.
You know, that's how he makes a living. And he has one of the best scenes in the show in season two when Levy, the lawyer, is like,
oh yeah,
he's defending one of Barksdale's crew, a guy named Bird.
Yeah.
And Omar has been called to the stand by the prosecuting attorney, right?
Yeah.
To testify against Bird. And so Levy gets up to cross-examine. And and Levy, like you've learned at this point, is just this really sort of slimy kind of, you know, he defends criminals that he knows are guilty, and he just tries to make as much money as he can off of these people.
Yeah.
He essentially, Omar equates Levy to himself.
Yeah, he basically says,
you do it with the briefcase, I do it with a gun.
Yeah.
But I think that's the other thing about Omar is he's another character that has a lot of wisdom. And so, you know, I think you tend to, or at least I do, gravitate towards those characters that seem to have a deep understanding of the way their world works.
Yeah. Well, and he's also, as you learn later on, like, I feel like at the beginning you like him because he is so, he's charismatic and he's fearless, you know, he's sort of a typical anti-hero in a lot of ways in the beginning, you know. And then as the show goes on, you start to see that he really does care about certain things and certain people.
Yeah.
And so I feel like in the end, in a lot of ways, he's the most heartbreaking character.
Oh, yeah.
What happens to him and what happens to the people around him is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And so you feel for him, you know, rather than just appreciating, you know, what he accomplishes or what he does in the show.
I think he exemplifies, you know, and I don't think this theme is really strong through the show, but, you know, when he does die and like in that episode, his death is treated like any other death, you know, by the other characters in the show. Like, no one laments him. Like, McNulty has sort of a passing, like, I think, comments about, you know, he finally got one, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the show, you know, he's in a body, he's in a body bag in the medical examiner's room, right?
Yeah.
And the wrong tag is on him. He's been misidentified.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I think, to me, that says, you know, no matter how... no matter how much wisdom you have, no matter how much you can be in the right in this world, you will be forgotten.
Yeah.
You know, like
the show creates this nobility around Omar that ultimately means nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
cause the system doesn't accept it.
Right.
And so
it's not recognized.
In the end, the system ignores him.
Yeah.
You know, and
which is, I mean, arguably a statement of the show, you know, sort of on, I think you could say that that's sort of what the city and the system does to people within it. You know,
he is, and I
marginalizes them.
Of all the characters, he is, he is like the most, I don't want to say like unrealistic, but he feels the most like a piece of literature or fiction just in that, you know, he's this really intense, really strong, rough character. He's gay. He cares intensely about certain people and certain things, but he's also very cold and callow about other things. In season 4 or 5, like, he's seemingly unkillable for a while. Like, people like Marlo's gunning for him, and he jumps out of like a 5-story building and lives. And like, he of everyone feels the most mythic.
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good way to put it.
And I think he's as far as like the show can go in terms of fiction. You know what I mean? He almost feels unreal, but he's like the only character that does.
Yeah.
Which makes his fall in the end that much more sort of upsetting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and the last moments that you spend with him, like I would say, like the last season, you know, you constantly are, I feel like you're constantly shocked at what the show does to him, you know, and how it sort of, he becomes a fairly pathetic, shadow of himself.
Yeah.
You know.
He and like, I think also from season 1, you keep waiting for him to get killed.
Yeah.
Because he's always in situations where he should be killed.
Yeah.
You know,
logic, well, and so many people dictates. On the show die for much less. Yeah. You know, or die.
And so by the time you get to, does he die in season 5 or 4?
It's 5. I think he dies in the second to last episode, maybe, or so last episode.
By the time you get to season 5, you're almost like feel safe with him. You're
right. Like, he's made it this far.
He might make it.
Yeah.
And then when he doesn't, it's a kid, like a little kid, shoots him.
A despicable little kid, too.
A kid like, that you hate.
Yeah.
And that you already spend
2 seasons hating this that kid.
And then he gives you the best reason in the world to hate him.
Oh, man.
It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
There's a lot of characters we haven't gone over. Lester Freeman, the Bunk.
Oh, Jimmy! One of the things that I got into The Wire in a group setting.
Yeah.
You know, it was after a lot of that precedent of you know, this being like, oh, such an incredible show. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't. It was the kind of thing where I felt like I needed to have that group support in order to actually commit myself to something like this, you know. But the moments with Bunk and Jimmy on a constant bender, seemingly like every episode, like if there was one like consistent thing that we could look forward to in every episode of The Wire, if there was one like sort of patterned occurrence that seemed to develop over the course of the first season, it was Jimmy and Bunk, McNulty and Bunk getting drunk and you know, falling down hillsides cars or
I love is like when you first introduce that dynamic, you feel like Bunk is kind of the more steady one.
Yeah.
Like of the two, like he's the less likely to have to get into trouble or to make mistakes. But then there are episodes where Bunk does like this dumbest stuff. You know, like he gets drunker than McNulty.
Yeah.
Like there's the episode where he's in some woman's house in the bathroom in her robe and his clothes are on fire in the bathtub and it's McNulty who comes to get him, right?
Yeah.
And you're just like, what the hell happened here?
Yeah.
And then Lester Freeman, who's the genius of the show and he's like McNulty was. Or he was McNulty.
You get
20 years
that
before we, you know, are introduced to these characters.
Yeah.
Like he was put into a department of the police where he was just at a desk.
He was on like evidence duty or something.
Because he pissed somebody off.
Right. He did the wrong thing to the wrong person.
And then
in the name of police work. Yeah.
And then through the investigation in season 1, he gets back into actual police work and
he's considered sort of useless by the organization as a whole, which is why he ends up on that detail.
Yeah. But now he gets to be in, you know, the homicide division again, and eventually on the what did they name that unit?
Special ops.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Yeah, or special crimes, major crimes, something
major
like that.
Crimes, major crimes, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Major ops.
Special major,
but he kind of by the end of it is as myopic as McNulty in the overall, like he's just like determined to do what he thinks is the right thing for police work, you know.
He becomes somewhat consumed.
Season four.
Well, before we go too far, well, actually, season 4 of this works because then it gets where you sort of see this come to a head. But I wanted to talk about Carchetti as kind of, God, it's almost like you could say that there's one in every organization. In a lot of ways, I feel like Stringer is kind of the McNulty of the Barksdale group, mm-hmm. in that he thinks he's doing the right thing for the organization, but really he's just doing the right thing for himself.
Yep.
And I feel like Carchetti is the same way, wherein it's really, really fascinating to watch Carchetti go from being this pretty much a shining knight of justice, you know, when you first meet him.
Yeah.
Like he's pretty steadfast in his belief that he wants to right things that he sees wrong.
Yeah.
And that's it.
He really does.
He does.
When you first meet him.
You feel he feels genuine in that pursuit.
Yeah.
And very quickly, almost as soon as he sees an opening, his goals and ambitions and drives change.
Yeah.
And it's not, he still professes, and I think he still believes that he is creating justice wherever he goes. And everything that he does, he sees it as a means to an end. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if I become mayor, I can do so much more.
Yeah.
You know, righting the injustices.
Yeah.
And then that's not good enough. Right. He's mayor for like 20 minutes.
If I become governor.
Right. Yeah.
Does he win the race in season four?
Like, I think he does become governor.
He's still running. When season four starts, he's campaigning.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's weird. His character in season three does seem very, you know, genuine, like he wants to do the right thing. And when season four starts, he is so weird. Like, he doesn't want to campaign. He hates, you know, talking to these people. He has the immortal line that I like to say, where he says, "I fucking hate it," about campaigning.
Yeah.
And that was where I was like, what is this accent that he's doing? And he just acts strange.
Yeah.
And then throughout that season, until he becomes hopeful that he can win, he's just like, doesn't want to be doing any, you know, what he's doing.
Yeah. He seems so, it's almost like, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he doesn't really actually want the job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And season four introduces us to the schools.
Yeah.
Season four is one of the most heartbreaking of the seasons.
Yeah. I think I've read and heard that, you know, season four is sort of the peak.
I think for a lot of people, they consider that's the best season.
Yeah. And, I can definitely see why. And I think, for me personally, it was the most emotionally affecting of the seasons.
It shows you how how these kids end up on the street.
Right.
Like how they're bred into these roles that they eventually, you know, and it also starts what I think of as the cycle of a new generation of, you know, these
of Barksdales and Omars. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you see, it gives you the four kids of Naaman.
Yeah.
Randy, Michael, and
Dookie.
Yeah. And they all have a trajectory that you see who they will become because you've seen these people previously on the, you know, previous seasons.
Yeah.
Like, so four and five, you follow these kids, two of them in particular go on into season five.
Yeah.
But you see where they're going and who they will become. And it's really interesting. But yeah, that it's neat to neat. It's really,
it's way cool.
Oh, it's so neat. It's interesting to see how the school prepares them for their street life.
Yeah. Yeah. Almost like it's inevitable.
Yeah.
Yeah. That they're going to end up there.
And Prez Belusky. He sort of comes into his own finally.
Yeah. He finally.
Season four. Who was the worst police officer ever. And, you know, gives up that and becomes a teacher. And he's kind of a horrible teacher for a while, but he kind of hits his stride
and figures it out
how to be a teacher.
Yeah.
He's another one that I think has a really interesting kind of trajectory through the show.
Yeah.
Like, at first you're like, what an idiot. You sort of like despise this guy. And then he becomes very vital to the investigations, but then he screws up enormously every time he leaves the office, he screws up in a horrible way. And in, was it season three?
Yeah.
He shoots a cop.
Yeah. Mistakenly.
I think I read somewhere that he's one of the only police officers who ever shoots a gun.
Yeah, that's true. You don't ever really see too much gunplay. Yeah.
But then, yeah, once he gets in the school system, he realizes, okay, this is where I should be.
Figures it out. Yeah. I think the part about season four that's really heartbreaking is that each of those kids has sort of a mentor.
Yeah.
They through circumstances become kind of attached to one of our like main adult characters that we've been following.
So Dookie has Prez.
Randy has Carver. Michael
Is it? I mean, it's kind of Marlowe.
It kind of becomes, well, is it Marlowe or is it Chris? I don't know.
I guess it's
that
more
sort of organization.
Chris.
You definitely get the sense that they're that Chris and Michael have fallen victim to the same type of thing, like a similar problem in their past.
You
get the impression, and it's never really explicitly spelled out, but you infer that there was maybe some paternal abuse. In their past,
Namond has Bunny, who we didn't even talk
Bunny
about
Colville.
Season three, and we didn't talk about Hamsterdam,
which is the legal drug zone.
Bunny Colvin, who's a lieutenant in West Baltimore, isn't he?
He's a lieutenant,
police department in West Baltimore, and he's like he essentially makes drugs legal,
right? He creates a free zone
where
empty houses.
Yeah, as long as they're not dealing drugs anywhere else, they're only dealing drugs in this place.
Right.
There's like three areas they can do it, and the
cops
mess
are not
going to
bust them.
And as long as there's no murders,
right?
And it works. It works.
I mean,
in the fiction of the show,
who
knows if it would actually work?
Right.
But it works in the show. And you're the whole time you're like, when is this all going to fall apart?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You're just waiting for it.
But then Bunny, of course, like when people find out, he's essentially kicked out.
Yeah.
You know, he's sort of pushed out of the police. And so he becomes a consultant for this university who's doing a study on kids who, you know, in the school system and the most troubled, I guess, kids. And sort of like, I forget what was it. I mean, the study was just like to see how they interact and if they can be schooled in a different way.
Right. Well, right. So I think it was sort of like if you take them out of
the
typical classroom.
Yeah, you don't let them disrupt the kids who are you know functional in class and put them together and you know try to educate them in a different way. Will that work? But Namond, who is put into that group, sort of eventually kind of warms up to Bunny as his mentor.
Yeah.
And those four kids all take I did not expect them to go where they went. Like,
you think
Namond is going to be a street kid.
Yeah.
Because his dad is Weebay.
Right.
Who
is part of the Barksdale organization.
Yeah. And so you're like, okay, he's going to end up on the street, you know, one of the major players. Randy, you think, is going to do well because his foster mother.
He's in a really good, supportive home environment.
And he himself seems
he's
like
smart.
A good kid.
Yeah.
He's smart, you know, in a different environment would probably thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Dookie.
He proves himself to be smart.
Yeah.
You know, in unexpected ways.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And he seems like morally, the most, good. You know what I mean?
He's not, he doesn't seem to be the least bit tempted by any of the street culture. Yeah.
And then Michael just seems like, he initially wants nothing to do with like Marlowe or any of his crew. So he also kind of feels like he's going to do well. Like he's going to be good in the end.
Well, and he's always looking out for his little brother.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Yeah.
But Namond ends up being, you know, a star student by season five on debate club and stuff because he's sort of taken under the wing of Bunny. Bunny adopts him.
Yeah.
Randy, God, he's one of the, that one really bums me out, but
it's hard. Yeah. That is probably the most, troubling dynamic. I think of that arc is seeing what happens to and really not through any fault of his own.
He
makes one mistake early on, and I think that ultimately it
is are you talking about when he tells?
Yeah,
he snitches.
He snitches.
Yeah,
right. And that ultimately causes his downfall.
And I think Carver was essentially supposed to protect him,
right,
and make sure that I forget what Randy expected something from Carver, and I can't remember what it was, but Carver falls down in some way and doesn't do what he was supposed to do.
Yeah,
for Randy, and so that leads to Randy's house being burned down. His foster mother is
put into the hospital.
Yeah,
yeah.
And so
he ends up in a home,
and he completely he just hates Carver. He loses all faith in any kind of institution.
Yeah.
And in season five, he's in an orphanage, essentially.
Yeah. Almost a completely different person than when you last saw him.
He's lost any and all, like, what's the word? Like, any happiness. I mean, there's no glint in his eye, for lack of a better phrase. And he's, you know, just hates life.
Yeah.
And then Dookie essentially takes...
He becomes Bubbles. Yeah, he becomes a junkie.
A heroin addict. And then Michael becomes...
Omar, essentially, yeah.
He eventually does team up or join up with Marlo, but then doesn't like that.
Yeah.
And decides to be a stick-up artist. You know? So that's what I love. It's like you see, okay, this is how Omar came to be, or this is how Bubbles came to be. It's a really interesting thing to see happen.
Yeah.
Which, should we talk about season five?
I guess we have to.
Which is one of my favorite seasons. I know it's like, a lot of people think it's, like season two is one of the least interesting, but it goes into the newsroom.
Yeah.
The newspaper and the media. And sort of media. And I just love, like, if you are a writer, this is the season for you, because the conversations that happen in that newsroom are so, just awesome.
They get so into the mechanics of
language
reporting and really kind of, I love the conversation that is had about the one freelance photographer who always puts a burning doll whatever in the foreground of his photos, where there's like this artifice of drama that the media, that was supposed to be basically the media, there's this implicit agreement that the media is going to give you a documentarian view of the facts, you know, like they are reporting the facts and constantly the lead newsroom guy, Gus, is constantly having to battle this
dramatization
of the facts, or in many cases, wholesale falsification. Yeah. You're just a creation of out of nowhere, these fake facts. And you really feel for him. I think
he's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, he's great.
And he incidentally is one of the directors of the show. I believe he directed the first and last episodes.
That's awesome.
But he is like, his scenes are just so amazing.
Yeah.
And I love his, when he mentors the other reporters, on the newspaper, and when he starts to see that the one guy, Scott, is making stuff up, and you just feel for him, because it's another character who isn't gonna win in the end. That Scott's the one who's gonna come out of this well off, and that Gus is
rewarded
the one,
essentially, for doing the wrong thing.
Exactly. Yeah. But the battles that he sort of fights are really interesting. And I also really like his interaction with Fletcher, I think is his name.
Yeah.
Who does a piece on Bubbles, and he's basically, Fletcher's like talking to Gus, and he's like, I want to do more on this story, but nobody wants the story. You know, he couldn't justify it to his bosses to do the story. And Gus is like, just take a couple days and see what you see.
Yeah. What happens. See what comes out of it.
And it's just like it's the best. It's like, I wish Gus was my mentor. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You want him to run the paper. Yeah, you don't want him to be constantly having to fight.
Yeah.
But again, he's almost in a lot of ways like Sabatka.
Yeah.
He's given himself to this dying institution.
Yep.
The idea of a legitimate newspaper.
Yeah.
And it's all for naught, really.
Yeah.
Because he ends up okay in the end. He doesn't lose out completely, but you definitely feel like he's defeated by the machine, or by the progress.
I think season five, I will say that it is the least believable in some ways, because this is where McNulty really goes too far and fabricates this whole serial killer thing, and it does sort of beggar belief that anyone would do this. Because he starts staging bodies so it looks like someone's killing homeless people so that he can get a wiretap.
Yeah.
So that he can follow. Is he on
for Stanfield, I think.
Yeah, Stanfield, Marlowe. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's basically funneling money that's dedicated to one investigation. He's funneling it to another investigation.
It's definitely the season where it feels the most like a show.
Yeah. Yeah, it's asking a lot of you, I think, as a viewer, to believe that, you know, what's happening is actually happening. But
and I think part of that is because a lot of the characters have hit a point where you feel like you're kind of done with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Lester and McNulty, you're kind of like, well, what's left
to
learn about these characters? And that's why I latch on to the newspaper aspect of it so much, because there's new characters to, you know, to try to understand. And I really bums me out that that's where the show ends, because I want more of them.
Yeah.
You know, but what they
in a way, McNulty sort of becomes a villain in that.
Oh, yeah. Fifth episode,
he is in the fifth season.
Extremely despicable.
And, yeah.
And you're just like, you know, it's funny because you as a viewer have the same reaction that every character has with McNulty. And that at first you're enchanted. You're like, what a great guy. Like, he's fighting for what's right, you know, and you know, screw everybody else. Like, we're going to do this thing. And by then you're like, you're such an asshole, McNulty. Let it go. You know,
this sort of just came to me as you're saying that. But like, you sort of, as a viewer, fall into the same prey that I think a lot of the characters do. And so wherein you put your faith in the institution of McNulty, you know, like, you're like, okay, he's the vanguard, you know, he's sort of this, you know, once, crazy.
You're like, once we get Stringer Bell and Avon, finally, you know, like, we'll be done. And then when McNulty's not done, you're like, what is wrong with you? You did it. Let it go. You know?
Yeah.
It's really good. And we didn't talk about, in season four, Bodhi has his end.
Oh, yeah.
And again, one of the best scenes between him and McNulty, where Bodhi kind of lays it out. He's like, I can't win. You know, there's no chance for me.
I feel old. I've been out there since I was 13. I ain't never fucked up a count, never stole off a package, never did some shit that I wasn't told to do. I've been straight up. But what come back? You think if I get jammed up on some shit, they'd be like, all right, yeah, Bodhi been there. Bodhi hang tough. We got his pay lawyer. We got a bell. They want me to stand with him, right? Where the fuck they at when they supposed to be standing by us? I mean, when shit goes bad and it's hell to pay, where they at? This game is rigged, man. We like them little bitches on the chessboard.
Pawns.
His death scene that we've recently learned is so significant
because... Yeah, well, just in the way it's staged and...
You know, early on in season one, he has the conversation with D'Angelo about chess. And D'Angelo's like, here's how, you know, the knights move in an L shape, rooks move back and forth. Pawns, you know, they can only move forward, but if they attack, they attack diagonally, etc. Right?
Yeah.
And so he, in season four, he essentially talks with McNulty. He knows that he's been seen talking to McNulty, and so he knows that's kind of it for him. Like, he's going to get killed. And he accepts it, basically. And so later on the corner that night, he is attacked. And he's, you know, standing on the corner, and there's three people kind of coming to get him. Two of them are coming diagonally like bishops.
Like bishops.
And he's firing diagonally like a pawn. And then someone comes out of the building, does an L shape at him, and comes up and shoots him like in the head.
Yeah.
And it is so, when I learned this, and when I watched that scene again, I was like, it was just reaffirming how amazing the show is.
Yeah. Like, and it's not something that you like, you can not know that.
Yeah.
At
and
all.
It's fine.
And it's still a deeply huge affecting scene. Yeah. It is still one of the, probably the most impactful scenes of the whole series.
Yeah.
Because you have built up this legacy and that, like, you've known Bodhi all this time.
Yeah.
But then, that additional layer to it is just what, like, sort of takes it from being just a really good show to, you know, kind of transcending TV in a way.
Yeah. But, yeah, season five kind of goes a little too far as being a show.
Yeah.
A lot of the characters that you love are kind of gone. Bodhi's gone. Prez, at least I really loved Prez, and Prez makes
you
one
come
appearance.
To love Prez, yeah.
McNulty is no longer the character you loved. Lester is also no longer the character you loved.
Yeah.
Bunk is so frustrated with McNulty that you're kind of upset, you know, that Bunk is not happy.
Yeah.
Omar gets killed, and he's also
undermined.
He
breaks his code, you know. Yeah. That's which in a lot of ways you could say his undoing is that, you know, where he goes against his word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Carcetti is just a mess and has been since season four. Carver's awesome.
Yeah.
Carver's
still
like,
pretty solid.
He's another character that I could have kept following to see where he goes. Daniels, I kind of, who we haven't talked about a whole lot.
Yeah.
But he, it's not that he isn't interesting to me, but he just kind of,
he's not quite dynamic enough.
Yeah.
You know, throughout the series, but you get the sense that he could be if he would act upon his impulses, but he never really does.
Things have clearly sort of wound down by season five, and I can see why people kind of lose interest there.
Yeah,
but I'm just so taken by the newspaper stuff that it's still one of my favorites to watch.
And I think the one current that runs throughout season five that is sort of rewarding, I guess, that gives you enough to go on as you get, as you've come to the end of it, is Bubbles, who we haven't really talked about either. But his story,
he's
I think,
the one character. I just interrupted you. Go ahead. I'm gonna shut up.
He's the one character.
You don't talk about
sucks.
Bubbles. I will.
Yeah, no, he actually sort of turns out okay. Like, his journey through the series is he suffers a pretty heavy blow in the fourth season, I think. Arguably the worst that any character has to confront. But he comes out of it. He comes out of the series probably in a better state.
Yeah.
Better for all he has endured than probably anybody else.
Unexpectedly, on the show. Too. Like,
yeah, you sort of write him off in the beginning.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you sort of feel like there's no way he's going to make it out of this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And he does.
He does.
And he comes out of it better than he went in.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah. And considering where he is at the beginning,
I
think there is something to be said for that. It's not like a negligible part of the show.
No.
The fact that he is a junkie, you know, essentially the absolute worst.
He's training other people to be junkies.
Yeah, exactly.
And he continues to do it up until season four.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, the training of someone being a junkie, he gets a kid killed.
Yeah.
And like that totally, you know, decimates him.
Yeah. And for a good long time too. That was another thing that I really loved about that season was he didn't bounce back. Yeah. You really watch him suffer. Yeah.
And he's based on a real person.
Oh yeah, that's right.
That's based on an actual criminal informant.
Informant, yeah.
That I think David Simon did a piece on, much like Fletcher does a piece on Bubbles.
Yeah.
I think that reflects what David Simon did with this other guy.
Sort of how he got to know the street.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Good on you, Bubbles.
I mean, we could keep talking about The Wire.
We could.
There's so many characters.
We'll have to do a part two.
Maybe we'll do The Wire part two. But I think we got it.
We covered a good stretch of.
I hope that if you're listening to this part, you've seen The Wire.
You better have.
Maybe you'll watch it again now.
Oh yeah,
I'm gonna do it.
You should watch it with us.
Yeah. Start episode.
Come on over. We're gonna watch it.
We're gonna watch it tonight.
Stop boogie.
We pulled all the food out of the fridge. We're gonna start it up.
Yeah.
All right.
But before we do that, we should put it in the hour.
Oh, okay.